businesses or the civil rights leaders, for various reasons, refuse or can't take a stand or have to go along with the administration, that's their business. But I'm afraid that I know that justice is indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for taking a little bit of time out of your evening to join us here on the program. Welcome to the program. This is AJC Radio, bringing the message of justice around the world. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. How's everyone doing this evening?
Doing great.
Doing pretty good, Sam.
Excellent. All right. Hey, Lisa, let's knock out that disclaimer before we get any further.
Okay, we can do that. We just want to remind everyone that we are not attorneys and that A Just Cause does not provide legal advice. You want to contact your personal legal advisor for all of your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of A Just Cause. And as always, we want to thank you for choosing to spend time with us this evening and for tuning in tonight.
It's all good.
Stop it, Sam.
Hey, Lamont, you know, we have some changes that are coming on the program, and we want to share that with our listeners to prepare them for it. Got some exciting things that are coming up.
Ladies and gentlemen of America, as you tune in to this program tonight, I ask you to pull out your calendars. If they're hanging in the dining room or in the kitchen over the stove, we're going to ask you to get a pen and jot this down. On June 4th, this radio network will be bringing to you a campaign that we have started entitled Spotlight on Capitol Hill. Now, that what that means is that we're going to actually have an opportunity to speak to issues that your legislators and those that are on Capitol Hill, elected officials, give you an opportunity to see what their passions are, what their vision is for America. I guarantee you on that cold night in November, on any election year, when you make your way out to the polls, you are going to those polls for a reason and for a purpose, and I presume that is to execute change in this country. We're going to have an opportunity to hear their viewpoints. We're going to have an opportunity to spotlight what's important to them, which ultimately is important to us as American citizens. So mark your calendars, call everybody all across the country. If you got family on the East Coast, the West Coast, the Midwest, wherever they might be, let them know what's coming to this network. It's going to be definitely informative and definitely educational that we might learn some things with our elected officials.
Thank you, Lamont. Our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. We'd like to encourage you to call in and give us questions or comments as we go through some of the subject matter. And this evening we're going to be talking about false confessions or coerced confessions that are gotten through the form of torture or other means of getting false confessions. And I think our listeners are going to be stunned by some of the things that they're going to hear. We're going to have a special guest is going to join us in a little while as well by the name of Stan Willis. Mr. Willis is an attorney, has quite extensive experience in defending cases and bringing litigation in situations where folks have been involved in confessions as a result of torture and otherwise. I've given out the number, but I know, Lamont, we have a recommendation to our listeners as far as the optimum way of joining us on the program, especially if they just want to listen.
Sure,
what do we want to recommend to them?
We're going to recommend folks, if you're online, where a lot of folks are listening to this radio show, to actually tune in. Go use the correct browser. You have Internet Explorer and a number of browsers out there. We've seen that people are having some better success hearing the program using Google Chrome. So if you have that option on your computer, we ask that you maybe go to use that browser. It may be a little bit easier to listen without the spaces and the gaps by it being Blog Talk Radio. So that may give you better results there.
Excellent. Thanks. Okay, so let's get rolling. Again, we encourage you to stay with us throughout the program. You will always get some knowledge that you didn't have, and we always bring you the absolute best information that we can find regarding the judicial situation in our country. Again, our phone number, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Don't be shy. Give us a call if you have a question or a comment. Also, our chat room is open, so you can join in the chat room if you have questions or comments there as well. We very often will pass along your questions through the chat room. Let's move on to our current news.
Yes, and we've got an article here that kind of eating at me just a little bit that I want to discuss. We've got an article here that was posted May 19th. It's titled, Former Police Chief and Wife Sentenced in Child Abuse Case. This is a child abuse case in Mount Airy, Georgia. The police chief and his wife were going to jail for allegedly keeping four adopted children locked in a room for years with little food. Now, what they're saying is that Richard and Cheryl Burton were facing 28 counts of child cruelty. Richard Burton was also charged with child molestation. They pleaded guilty to four of those child cruelty charges on Monday. In exchange, all other counts, including child molestation, were dropped. They received sentences of 10 years each. Now, this is what really gets me. They'll serve 25 consecutive weekends in the county jail. The rest will be served on probation.
Wait.
Yeah.
Say that again, because I think our listeners probably, that didn't register. They'll catch up with it in a minute, but say it again so it'll sink in.
On your 10-year sentence, they're going to have to serve 25 consecutive weekends, not in prison, in the county jail, which there is a difference, and the rest will be served on probation. Now, they also said that as a part of the plea agreement, the Burtons were given first offender status. They won't have a felony criminal history.
Wow.
And Richard Burton is not required to register as a sex offender.
Right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I can tell you, Lisa, we call that unequal justice in this country. That's exactly what it is. Now, how those horrific crimes that they did plead guilty to, there was a time when at least if you had a case where children were neglected, where they were put in situations, judges came very, very hard on that because you're definitely jeopardizing the lives of innocents here.
Absolutely.
For a former police chief to plead to something like this, well, no wonder they pleaded. I don't have to register. I don't have to spend no more than 25 weekends in county jail.
Well, and the thing, when you look at this, the other troubling part of it, if they, okay, they pled guilty to four child cruelty charges. Now, you're not telling me a child cruelty is a misdemeanor, but they will have no felony criminal record. So they got misdemeanor counts on child cruelty. And the article shows why it's possible. This is the part that gets you. The chief assistant DA, Eddie Staples, said he made the deal partly. Now, he's full of crap right here. He made the deal partly to avoid having the children testify at trial. But he says Richard Burton's, that's the chief. Richard Burton's connections also came into play. That's the sickening part. Why do your connections come into play if you committed a crime?
See,
You're talking about
child. Connections should have nothing to do with your sentence.
That's right.
Now, granted, I mean, some of these charges could be fabricated. It may not all be true. I understand that fully because I've seen it happen 101 times. But for what they did plead guilty to,
absolutely,
that is ridiculous. Now, the article also says that the witness list for the defense included law enforcement officers from the community. And Staples said that those people were going to go into court every day and tell the jurors these are credible people. And they were going to come and testify to Richard Burton particularly, but the Burton's good character. Now, when you look back at the IRP 6 case, when they tried to say anything in regards to their character, they were stopped by a crooked judge named Christine Arguello and told, your character is not on trial. How is it you're calling me a criminal, you're calling me a thief, you're calling me a liar, but my credibility is not on trial?
Your character.
My character is not on trial. What are you talking about? Of course my character is on trial.
That's right. You're calling
me a crook.
Well, look at this. I'll tell you this right now, and I said it before. Maybe, folks, you're not getting it. Turn your radio, your speakers hooked to your computer. Turn it up a little bit, and maybe we can get this over. Whenever you make the statement that connections came into play in a judicial process, we have lost it.
That's right.
As a society. We said it last week. I'm going to say it again. It may sound like a broken record, ladies and gentlemen, but if anybody sees a poster stapled to a tree saying missing in action and Lady Justice is on there, we're going to ask that you send her our way.
That's right. Tackle her.
Tackle her, because I'm going to tell you something. Lady Justice doesn't see connections.
No, she does not.
Lady Justice doesn't see color. Lady Justice doesn't see you know what I'm starting to think? Lady Justice got kidnapped. She didn't just go missing. Somebody kidnapped
her. That's right.
I think she's bound and gagged in a closet somewhere.
Something's going on. Ladies and gentlemen, get involved. We're going to give you an opportunity. Sam, throw that number back out to these listeners if you want to chime in on this conversation.
347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. Also, you know, on that, Lamont, you know, we got the chat room open. So, you know, shoot us a note over there. I mean, we want to see, you know, in this particular story, is there any fairness that you see in this as far as, you know, where is the justice? And,
right.
and just, you know, just enter a little note in the chat room and say, no justice. I want to see how many people will put in there, no justice.
And when you look at this, they always say nobody's above the law, but I beg to differ. Here you have a police chief. He pleads guilty to child cruelty. The fact that he's a police chief should not give him a pass. It should not give him leniency. He should be held to a higher standard.
Absolutely.
You're the police chief.
Right.
You say that, and you have men out there that are putting their life on the line as part of your force, and you say, I'm the chief. I'm the one who makes the example that we will uphold the law and we will lay down our lives to serve and protect. You holding kids hostage in a room, beating them, throwing up against wall. And the article says that the new mother of these kids, their new adoptive mother, she said the children bear physical and emotional scars. These kids are from 13 to 19. So if they have been coerced as little children, you say, well, maybe the stories are blown out of proportion. You got a 19-year-old saying, when I was a kid, he threw me up against the wall. He put leftover food that wasn't fit for him to eat. He threw that into a pot of cold noodles, and that's what he fed me. And I have physical scars to show that. And what does he get? The weekend guaranteed his county jail stay is going to be better than anybody else in county. If you go to county, they're going to give you a piece of green bologna on some stale bread. When he goes... Watch what I would like to see what he orders in for his meal on that Saturday night, the first night he stays in. I bet you'd have something to do with porterhouse and some couscous.
They'll probably let him order in pizza.
Well, Lamont, I'm sure you could shed a little light on the difference between county jail and prison.
Well, look, this is very sad to say. You would rather spend your time in prison than county jail. That's how horrible county jail is.
Unless you're the chief of that county.
Now, I think Cliff makes a good point here. How do you, the connections of you being the police chief, as you said, should hold you to a higher standard.
Yes.
The president of the United States is held to a higher standard. The mayor of a community who oversees the police department in all cities, the chief of police is answerable to the mayor.
That's right.
He's held to a higher standard. Our elected officials, our congressmen, our senators, they are held to a higher standard.
Yes, they
are. That is the entire fabric of our society, that those that lead must lead by example, especially when you're talking about law enforcement. You're talking about judges are supposed to lead by example. They are held to a higher standard. How in the world does a police chief who instructs officers to enforce the law and to protect children get a lesser sentence than the average person on the street that doesn't even come from his background?
Well, and he doesn't do what he's teaching.
That's exactly.
And the DA admittedly and puts on paper, says to the media, it's because his connections. That's the reason I, as the DA, made this deal, basically to get him leniency because of his connections as the chief. So this is, I mean, how do the people in that community see this as being fair?
Well, it sounds like an involuntary resignation by the district attorney's office.
Well, and you know,
that, I mean, that's what it sounds like to me.
That's what it should be.
This is a verbal resignation.
That I'm siding with the chief, so it's time for you guys to go ahead and fire me. Don't elect me this time.
Don't elect me because of his connections, you know, and I guarantee you, and I'm just going to say it like it is, if that was an African-American charged with touching kids and doing these things, I promise you, the community would be begging for him to be put under the jail and never get out. But a police chief, how does a community excuse that?
That's what's crazy.
Excuse me, I think Dr. Martin Luther King made the point. I read somewhere that we have a right to protest. You protest that which you object to. Where is the community, people in that community, speaking out against what this chief did?
Yeah, why isn't anybody saying, hey, wait a minute, what is going on here? This is wrong.
And that's because you got the DA, the chief, the sheriff, the judges, all the prosecutors, everybody who's a part of this case is basically saying, we're giving him a pass. If you say anything about it, you're basically going to be fired. So shut up. And if the people start talking, tell them to shut up or you're going to arrest them and put them in jail for more than 25 weekends.
And, you know, countless times you see cases that come along and it talks about people in positions of authority or people in positions of trust. Now, in this situation, you got a double whammy.
Exactly.
Or triple whammy, whatever. I mean, you got the police chief who is in the ultimate position, supposedly, ultimate position of authority in that town, ultimate position of trust as well. He's been entrusted to uphold the law, but then as a father, so to speak, the system has entrusted him to act as a father to foster children. So he and his wife together have undermined, and you used the term Lamont, social fabric. You know, I was just reading something here just a moment ago talking about, you know, our social fabric is eroding because of the level of dishonesty, the level of corruption at the hands of people in positions of trust.
Well, let's just chime in on that about the fabric. Now, you folks that have sewing machines, you have your kids running out in the front yard, they may skin the knee and they get a hole in their jeans. You can put a little piece of fabric to cover the hole. I remember years ago there was a speech called "The Patch Ain't Big Enough." I will leave the guy nameless. You know, America can't, the patch, the hole is so big, the patch won't cover what's going on here. The fabric, it's not only eroded. I'm saying skin, man. I'm not even saying any fabric no more.
Right.
So what do we do with that? We have to replace the fabric. What is that fabric? It is our morality. It is our ethic. It is the oath that we took as public servants, to serve and protect. You see it on every police car in every city, to serve and protect. But you got a police chief messing around with little kids on whatever level. If you were cruel to that kid, you pleaded guilty, as Lisa said, to that charge. That is insanity to me. And the fact that it's not on CNN saying, man, this community is outraged. That's why people are not, they're not listening.
Exactly.
You're not talking.
These are children that he committed these crimes against. Children. How do these officials say, it's okay, we're giving him a pass? You're talking about kids. They are innocent. They need to be protected. He committed a crime against them, and because of his position and connections, he gets a pass.
Yep.
This is why America feels like that the police, law enforcement, law and officials are above the law. This shows that in some communities they are.
Stay right there. We're going to take a quick break. Our phone number is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. This is AJC Radio, bringing the message of justice around the world. When we come back shortly after the break, attorney Stan Willis will be joining us as we talk about false confessions and tortured confessions, and you know, we talk about people in positions of trust and so forth. Lamont, did you have something?
Ladies and gentlemen, put the chicken up. Get the dessert on the table, maybe a cup of coffee. Get a cup of tea. Get a Red Bull if you're feeling a little down tonight. But guess what? We're just getting started here on AJC Radio. Stand by.
Do you know anyone who's been sent to prison who is innocent? The United States is experiencing record numbers of exonerations in cases where people were wrongly convicted of crimes that they did not commit. If you believe that no one should be sent to prison for crimes they didn't commit, there is something that you can do today. By remembering A Just Cause with a monthly, annual, or one-time donation, you can help in the fight against wrongful convictions. Call A Just Cause, toll-free, at 1-855-529-4252. Again, 1-855-529-4252. Or visit www.a-justcause.com and click the donate button. Wrongful convictions are wrong. Let's be the voice of those who can't speak from behind the wall. A Just Cause is a 501c3.
Studies show that it can take an exoneree over 3 years to receive compensation for a wrongful conviction. Over 25% of exonerees get nothing. That's right. Absolutely nothing. And of those who do receive something, over 80% receive less than $50,000 for each year of wrongful imprisonment. This form of injustice must be fought with legislation. We invite you today to get involved now. Call A Just Cause toll free at 1-855-529-4252 to join us in the fight for justice. That number again is 1-855-529-4252. Adequate compensation for those who have been wrongfully convicted and in prison is a small way of correcting a gross injustice. Join us, won't you, for the fight that change will finally come.
If you were convicted of a crime you did not commit, what would you do? How would you feel to have your basic human rights stripped from you in a matter of seconds?
Each day, thousands of crimes are committed, and each day, thousands of people nationwide are convicted of crimes they did not commit.
Eyewitness misidentification is the number one factor that causes most wrongful convictions. This is due to the mind filling in blanks with things that seem right, or things that they hear from others, such as the police, media, and other witnesses. If you are unsure if the person that stands before you committed the crime, do not put an innocent person in jail. Don't convict the innocent.
Just Cause Radio, AJC Radio, I should say, bringing the message of justice around the world. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Lamont Banks, Cliff Stewart, and Lisa Stewart. Thank you for joining us this evening and taking time out of your schedule. Our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. And as we stated earlier, if you have any questions or comments, give us a call on that line. And but for your best experience as far as listening to the program, we ask that you go through the Chrome browser and Google Chrome. And then also, our chat room is open, so we want to invite you also to provide questions or comments there as well. Mike.
Yes, and it looks like we got another current news we're getting ready to do now. And I believe this is showing some issues in Chicago. Stand by. Okay, so this is what we're going to do. Cliff, did you pointed the story out to me on break that Chicago to pay $5.5 million to victims of police torture. Now, that goes right into what we plan on talking about doing this program tonight.
Right.
It says here that Chicago will pay a total of $5.5 million to dozens of people almost all black men, tortured by the city's police in the 1970s, 80s, and early 90s, and make other reparations under an ordinance approved by the city council on Wednesday, which is the first of its kind in the United States. Now, if my math is correct, Cliff, we're looking at, what, 30, 40 years here?
Yeah, since the 70s.
Wow.
I mean, you know, that's been almost 45 years ago.
And how many people are we talking about?
We're talking
over 100?
Yeah, over 100 people.
5.5 ain't enough.
It's not much money. And
if you do
the
math over 40 years.
Yeah, you say, you know, they're not getting paid much. And the thing is, not all 100 of them are getting paid. They say that only a certain amount of them are eligible for this reparation, but they are saying that it will be dozens of them. So it's not all 100, but I think they're looking at this more as a step in the right direction. But when you look at this article and you see what the United Nations community is saying,
that's right.
They said that basically they're putting this right up there with torture. I mean, the international, or who was it? Chicago Torture Justice Memorial, the co-founder, Joey Mogul, he says, we should in fact call them international human rights violations, talking about these these tortures, so we can put it on the world stage and compare it to other atrocities elsewhere because they are equivalent. So those who say, okay, you know, America's system is the best in the world, no. Let's deal with what the facts are. Let's look at the numbers. When you compare this to what's going on around the world, they say that the torture in Chicago. This is America. This is America. You know, inner city, the urban, everything that has to do with police forces. That this is equivalent to human rights violation.
Let me ask you a question, Cliff. On this story, I want to make sure I got this. My hands wrapped around this. This is in the jail, not the prison.
This is in the jail. Yes.
Okay. So if I'm not mistaken. And we talked about a bus coming and leaving town a while ago about the presumption of innocence. So these folks are innocent at this point.
They're innocent. This is you know, just like the topic of the show. This is to get their confession. I mean,
wow.
This article is saying that these men in custody were subjected to electric shocks, burns, and mock executions, among other brutal acts, predominantly in order to extract confessions. And this was by this one crazy, you know, rogue cop, the former Chicago police commander, John Berg. And it says from 72 through 91, Berg and his officers allegedly tortured more than 100 African-Americans from the city's impoverished South Side. This has been going since 1972. They called his group the Midnight Crew.
Wow.
Because they would take you in there, they beat you, to electrocute people.
And what's the guy's name, that detective up in New York?
Oh, you talking about our buddy Scarcelli?
Yeah, so it sounds like Chicago has their own version of Scarcelli.
Right, it's probably his cousin. Somewhere along the line, these two mental nutcases they have the same concept that
and it's
I'm
the
going
same
to,
time frame.
Yeah, the same time frame. It's like from the 70s to the 90s, pretty much pre-internet, video. I mean, you know, what was it, 92 when Rodney King was on video getting his head bashed in by several cops? This is the type of things that went on. So this shows that this was a nationwide epidemic, and they're finally coming to grips with it. But I thought it was, to say that this is on the same level as human rights violations, America needs to come to grip with what's going on in the backyard by our law enforcement. That's the issue here.
Well, I'll tell you right now, this is what is so insane to me, ladies and gentlemen. And if you're listening to this, you know, we got news information that, you know, you hear reports on the news about torture and by soldiers and UN violations of acts of, you know, doing crimes of wartime. You're talking about the big debate that was on the news was about waterboarding, that this stuff shouldn't be going on,
right,
and all this type of torture. But we're saying, and how does America point the finger at any other country in the world when we are actually torturing innocent, according to the laws that we live by, innocent people? They haven't been committed. They haven't been, convicted of a crime.
They are there under questioning. So there is no charge yet.
Charges.
It's just like, you're going to give me a confession, say you did it. I got you in questioning, and I want a confession. That's what this is about.
I'll tell you what, Ms. Donna Billick, ADA in Colorado Springs, El Paso County, went that far in my case to intimidate an 8-year-old. And when the 8-year-old made the statement, absolutely not, Ms. Donna Billick took it upon herself to say, that's not the answer I want to hear, young lady. Well, first of all, Ms. Billick, it's a little girl. So when you start acting to intimidate and to coerce, then why don't somebody answer that question for me? Where is our justice system gone to? And how many innocent people, and for the record, let me put this on the record, I was completely exonerated of all charges, of all criminal charges and allegations, false testimony, blatant lies, and inconsistencies. So you want to know what's going on in America? Innocent people are going to jail every single day. So you got people sitting in a police station where we're supposed to be looking up to them for answers. And they're back there with their own individual torture chamber to get confessions out of people, because the bottom line is we want convictions. How sick has America become?
Well, and, you know, even in this situation in Chicago, when you look at the former police commander, John Burge, it gets even worse than that. He was fired in 1993 for mistreating a suspect, but it took until 2010 for him to be convicted, only convicted of perjury. He wasn't convicted of mistreating people. He was not convicted of torture. He wasn't convicted of any physical offenses against anyone. He was convicted of perjury.
Right.
Now check this out. About halfway through his sentence, he was released into a halfway house. The man still collects $4,000 a month pension.
Who was collected? Hold on a second.
That's the man. This man, Berg.
Okay. The one who was the head honcho who was torturing everybody.
So
while he's in prison, and now he's out, and he has cost the city of Chicago now $67 million for folks who have filed claims, but the statute of limitations has passed, so a lot of the people who were tortured by him can't even bring a claim, but he's still getting $4,000 a month.
And that's pension, is that correct?
That's pension.
And let me... Okay, folks, this is absolutely okay. I'm not one that gets at a loss of words often, but I'll tell you this. The taxpayers then have paid, if I'm not mistaken, that fund is paid by the city.
Yeah.
Is that correct? So the pensions are paid by taxpayers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let me make sure we're clear. For your torture, this is The Price is Right. Come on down. You've tortured kids and receive your prize, and we're going to go ahead and honor you for torturing kids and doing those Chicago
right, for 30 years from the 70s to from 72 to 91, so for 20 years, because it says, okay, Berg was fired in 93. He was never criminally charged with torture.
Never criminally charged against this,
but he was convicted, like Sam said, 2010 in lying about torture in a case. And served 4.5 years. He was released from a Florida halfway house in February. What was that, last year, Sam?
October.
Well, October he was released. He finished his complete sentence, so he got out of the halfway house in February.
Yeah.
So everything is done, and he's getting a pension. But how do you say we have spent, what was the number, Sam, that Chicago spent?
$67 million.
$67 million. He's never been criminally charged with torture, although we have 100 people. And the city of Chicago have admitted that, yes, he did.
Is there a press conference? Can you check your CNN breaking news? Perhaps the folks are protesting on the streets in Chicago. Research team, is there anybody protesting right now in Chicago?
Right.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, to join us on this conversation is our guest, Stan Willis. And Mr. Willis is an attorney in Chicago, and I'm sure that he can shed some light on some of this. I mean, if the walls could talk in some of the areas that he's been in, I'm sure that look how many years it took to bring – I'm not even going to say to bring him to justice. They didn't bring him anywhere. I could envision this guy even saying, you know, I can do the perjury time, you know, sitting on a nail or something. It just seems as though that this guy was just that arrogant. And obviously, if he was heading up a militia, basically,
right,
is what it was.
Exactly.
He was heading up a militia that was out there torturing people, and he said, "Sure, I'll do 4 years. Just continue giving my and who knows how much other money the man was getting under the table to just not torture people." Welcome to the program, Mr. Willis. How are you doing this evening?
It's my pleasure. How are you?
We are doing well, thank you. So, Mr. Willis, in Chicago, as you probably are listening to us, talking about decades of cases where the Chicago police tortured people. And basically, I mean, there's one article here that we're looking at that says that for all practical purposes, the city jails were used as torture chambers. What do you know about that?
Well, this particular form of police violence, we learned about it in about 1988. The first case came to the office that I was a partner in at the People's Law Office. And the person who brought it to us was a young man who had gotten charged and convicted of murdering a police officer. In fact, there were two police officers, and these two young men had killed both of them, Andrew and Jackie Wilson. Andrew Wilson had filed a petition with the Supreme Court, said he had been coerced or beat up, actually. And his sentence was reversed, and he had a new trial, but he was found guilty of the murder, but the tortured confession didn't come into the case. And so we had to decide if we were going to file a civil suit on behalf of Andrew Wilson against John Burge and others, and we decided to. I think in 1989, the case went to trial. It was in a federal district court. And during the course of the trial, our team was on trial, we start getting letters from inmates from around the state. We start getting calls, anonymous calls, from police officers who worked out of Area 2 while this was going on. This is Southside Chicago. Basically saying, this is the tip of the iceberg. And we knew that there was something going on because they were all saying the same thing. John Burge used various instruments that were very different than what cops were using to coerce confessions. He had contrived an instrument that had a cord that was attached to a battery that emitted hundreds of volts of electricity into the body. It had clips on the end of it where they would clip the testicles or the earlobes or other parts of the body, and then they would crank this device, and they would shock this victim. They would put plastic bags over their head like garbage bags, and they would suffocate them, and these victims would pass out, and they would revive them, and then they would continue the torture. They used cattle prods, and you may or may not know what a cattle prod is, but it's an electrical device that you use on animals, on cattle. You know, when they're herding cattle to keep them in line, they would hit them with this cattle prod. And all that, and of course they use, beatings and Russian roulette, all kinds of things. And we learned about this through as we were doing the trial, and we were getting calls from these victims. All of these victims were young black boys and young black men. And that started the movement. We started putting the word around, and of course the lawsuit was filed, and people come to trial, and people started organizing, particularly lawyers and progressive folks who are accustomed to organizing around the city. And we organized, and we did everything that one can do within the context of a democratic society. We filed lawsuits, we filed post-conviction petitions, we had hearings before the city council, we had hearings before the county board, we tried to get the local prosecutor to intervene and prosecute, we tried to get the state's attorney, we tried to get the U.S. attorney, we sent a delegation to Washington to talk with the Justice Department. We finally got a special prosecutor appointed. We did everything. There was nothing left to be done. I'll put it like that. In 2005, this is kind of personal history, I was home with a broken ankle. And while home, I was listening to public radio, and they were talking about torture. But they were talking about torture because at that time, President Bush was trying to change the definition of torture because torture was going on in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. You will recall that. And it came to me that, you know, they're talking about torture, and we got torture here. Maybe we should kind of put this out in the world community somehow, you know, file something someplace. I didn't have no idea how you did that. Nobody else did. But I convened a meeting at my apartment at the time because I wasn't coming out. I had a cast on, and I talked to my comrades about it. You know, they kind of said, yeah, okay, let's think about it. So I did the research, and we started meeting, and we filed a petition with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is an organization that's part of the Organization of American States. That's kind of like our local UN in a sense. And we had a hearing. They invited us to Washington, D.C. We went to Washington, D.C., I think in the fall of 2005, and we put on evidence. Members of the State Department came because we were going after the United States at this point. And we had a hearing. Nothing happened, but they were gracious, and they, you know, they told us they believed us. The next year, we were invited to go to the United Nations by a group called the U.S. Human Rights Network, a very good group. They're trying to build a human rights movement in the United States, and it was founded out of Howard. And one of our comrades went, Joey Mogul, and I could not go because I had an argument before the appellate court and federal court. I did go in 2008. And in 2006, the Committee Against Torture, in their concluding observations, these treaties have a procedure that, you know, they require the state to come down and be examined on certain issues related to the treaty. They mentioned the John Birch case, and they directed the United States to investigate the John Birch case and to do it immediately. And it wasn't long after that that the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Northern District of Illinois started a legitimate investigation of John Birch because I got advised of it. I actually met with them to give them some ideas of how to go after Birch, me and two of my other lawyers in the case. And within months, John Birch got indicted. So I attributed the our going before the United Nations, that is, internationalizing the torture in Chicago, and the United States being embarrassed by that as the factor that caused John Birch to get indicted. And I firmly believe in this international exposure because I was involved in the anti-colonial, anti-apartheid movement back in the late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, as you, some of y'all may know, that our brothers and sisters on the continent was using these mechanisms. They were going to the United Nations and raising these issues of apartheid and colonialism. And so it was that factor, I believe, I'm convinced, that caused the United States to direct the local U.S. Attorney's Office to go after John Birch, and they did. But by the time they went after John Birch, all of the serious offenses had been, all the statute of limitations had run by that time, because nobody else would do it.
So, Mr.
Willis, you know, 2.5 decades.
Yeah, so, Mr. Willis, you said that most of these cases were centered around the south side of Chicago. So,
black south side of Chicago. Let's be clear. The black side of Chicago, south side, the black side of the
That's
town,
exactly
yeah.
where I was going. I was just getting ready to say, I don't think we have to guess a lot about the ethnic makeup of these folks
that were being brutalized
by this man. But, we wanted to make that very clear. And, you know, some of the things that you were going down as far as that shopping list of things that this man pulled together as far as torturing people, I mean, it sounds like he may have been the inventor of the taser and also waterboarding. I mean,
he had been in Vietnam, and it's our understanding that he had done some, he had learned how to torture victims in Vietnam. And so he brought those skills back to Chicago Police Department.
Yeah.
And well, use them on our kids.
Mr. Willis, thanks for joining us here, and we just want to ask that you sit tight just for a second.
Sure.
We do have to take a quick break. And Lamont.
And I'll tell you right now, America, the rating of Just Cause Radio, AJC Radio, just went to adult only. We are hearing stories of torture, horror, and things that are unmentionable. Tuck little Johnny in the bed and little Sue. Give them a midnight snack before they go to bed, maybe a Twinkie or a cupcake, but we're getting ready to get real here, and it's getting ready to get all adult. Ladies and gentlemen, this is AJC Radio. Come on back. We're just getting started. Do you have a big brother? Well, I have a big brother, and I'm pretty sure that you and I experience some of the same things with a big brother. Big brothers will always be big brothers, right? I'm sure you'll agree. Well, my brother gets up in the morning. He takes a shower, heads to work, and at some point during the day, he's going to exercise and get that workout, as we all do. And of course, depending on what's going on, he's going to sit down for two or three meals during the course of his day. And also, depending on what else is going on, he'll probably get caught up on current events and maybe take a few moments to turn a page in a book. How about your big brother? Some of the same stuff, right? Oh, did I mention that my big brother does all of that stuff? But he actually has to have permission a lot of times before he can do it. You see, my big brother was wrongfully convicted of a crime that he did not commit. That's right. That may sound shocking, huh? He's in prison. Wrongful convictions impact families in ways you cannot begin to imagine. But I've decided that I'm going to do something about it. And I extend an invitation to you to come on board and join me in this fight. You see, I'm helping to be a voice for my big brother and others who have been wrongfully convicted. We'd like you to take a few moments today and call a Just Cause, where we fight for justice. You can call us toll free at 1-855-529-4252. That's 1-855-529-4252. Join with us as we fight for justice and for all big brothers across the land.
Sergeant Michelle Garcia served meritoriously in Iraq and has the medals to prove it. Soon after leaving the Navy, Lieutenant Chris Scott found a job, a home, and started a family of his own. Corpsman Richard Stokely took the skills he learned in Vietnam and put them to good use as a paramedic. But soon after leaving the military, each of these veterans fell on hard times and faced homelessness. Even after Michelle lost all her savings, even after Chris wasn't able to pay his mortgage, and even after Richard battled alcoholism for years, they each reached out for help when they needed it most. A simple phone call put them in touch with a trained professional from the Department of Veterans Affairs. That call got Michelle a place to stay until she could afford one of her own, put Chris in touch with employment assistance, and found Richard a substance abuse program. These veterans are success stories not only for how they were able to help others while serving their country, but for how they were able to let others help them. If you know of or are a veteran in need, make the call.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Just Cause AJC Radio, and that particular noise that you hear is when the glory days of Chicago were. And if anybody knows anything about the game of sports of basketball, that song brought good memories. But tonight we have chimed in on a discussion and a topic of horror, and the days are not as glorious as they were then. And we come back with Stan Willis, who is joining us, and we're happy to have you tonight. Sam?
So, Mr. Willis, we want to thank you for the introduction that you gave to the situation there in Chicago. As we began to do more research into the torture and the situations there, and as you talked about it before going to the break, and to find out that it's really hitting a lot of the African-American community on the south side of Chicago. Again, welcome to the program, Mr. Willis.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Now, you know, one of the things that we were talking about before the break also was the amount of time that it took to bring justice against this officer, John Byrd. And you laid it out pretty clearly for us. I mean, there were a lot of hurdles that you and your team had to go through in order to bring attention to this man. And you said that finally the Justice Department took note, the federal prosecutor took note, and you were able to execute some sort of justice against him. Is that just because of the nature of the culture in Chicago or in the Illinois area when it comes to law enforcement, or is it just it just took that amount of time in order to get a tight case against him?
No, I don't. I think yeah, certainly it's in Chicago, but it's all over. I mean, it's torture in Chicago, but this police committing crimes against black people with impunity, you know, nothing happening. We've seen it now because the youth are moving on it, but it's been going on for a while.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah, you know, the war on drugs started. We attribute that to Ronald Reagan. He's the one that began to pump millions and millions of dollars into local communities to go after drug crimes. In fact, the drug crimes were really not a real problem, but somehow he thought there was a need to make it a war on drugs. And then there was a war on gangs. And all of that was kind of coded language. That was really a war on young black people. Because we see during that same time period that the prison rate began to go up and the money going into prison, building prisons began to go up. And a lot of that was fed by the federal government. So we end up with what we call now the mass incarceration of black people. And a lot of that started in the late 70s and early 80s. You know, it kind of started on the Bush, but it got a real impetus under Reagan. And indeed, and your listeners may not want to hear this, it got a huge boost under Clinton. And but lots of money to build prisons and to incarcerate under his administration. So I think it's in that we examine this question of, you know, black people being incarcerated. Burge is an extreme form, but it's going on all over the country.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of my questions is, I mean, you look at this, Rahm Emanuel comes out and says, hey, you know, I'm going for mayor. I need these votes, so I'm going to do something. How is it that in this particular case, and, you know, we'll move along for Burge in a minute, but how is it that he never was brought up on criminal charges for torture when all these things happen to say, you know, you cost the city $66 million, we got to go into reparations for all these people. It's been proven that you tortured all these young men for 20 years. How is it that he was never brought up on the criminal charges? Where did that fall out at? And I mean, I know the city fought it, but how did it get past Rahm Emanuel when he finally came to this conclusion that something needed to be done?
Well, it was even earlier than that. The torture cases became known under the Daley administration in the early 80s. Mayor Daley was in office at that time. You know, Harold Washington passed away, and Daley won the office. Daley was the state's attorney, and the Andrew Wilson case that I told you about. It was the first one we knew about. He was tortured, and the the doctor that attended his wounds sent a note to the state's attorney at the time, letting him know that there was something going on here. He ignored it. And so under his watch, the torture went on throughout the 80s and 90s, and he did nothing about it, and he knew about it. And so when he became mayor, he had an interest in not doing anything about it because he didn't do anything about it as a state's attorney. He could have stopped it right away, but he didn't. Not only did he didn't know about it, these cases was going before primarily two major courts in Chicago, 26 California and Markham, which is on the south side. So there were probably something like 40 judges at 26 in California during that time period, and probably some less in Markham. These judges were sitting on this bench where these young men were coming before them with motions to suppress statements that had been made, you know, as a result of the torture. These judges were listening to this evidence of over well over 100 victims. None of these judges said, wait a minute, I've heard that before. This is very unusual. This modus operandi is very new. These people being tortured by some kind of box, and this has never happened before. I'm going to report this to somebody. None of these judges did that. So the state's attorney knew it. These judges knew it. The prosecutors knew it because they're the ones going over the area to taking these statements, and they knew about it. Nobody did anything about it. So it was like a circle of people that knew about it that decided it wasn't important enough because these were black boys and these were black men, and they were not going after these white cops and put them in prison because they tortured black boys. It just wasn't going to happen.
Right, and I think it goes to Lamont says all the time, here on AJC Radio, that it's the culture that that is laid out in these different communities and these law enforcement areas. The culture there in Chicago was, hey, from the state's attorney down, and who knows? I mean, maybe even the governor. Who knows who all knew about this and said absolutely nothing? But the culture was to ignore it because, like you say, These are black boys, and really, who cares? We need to get them off the street anyway. You know, and the mantra is they may not be guilty of this, but they're guilty of something. So if we torture them into giving us a confession, then, hey, we get these little whatever you want to call them, we get them off the street, which is go ahead.
Well, look at this part of the culture. John Burge's boss, John Burge was a commander, and he had a boss. His boss was black. Leroy Martin, he became superintendent for a period of time. There were black detectives in Area 2 that knew about this. They came forward after they retired because I represented three of them. They knew about it. They let it happen. So it's even deeper than that. Black officers knew that these boys were being tortured, and they did nothing about it. So I don't know how you explain that part of the culture, but it goes on in many cities where there's a strong culture, a police culture. They even keep black officers in line when their own people are being shot down in the street, and in the case of Chicago, tortured.
And Mr. Willis, is from your perspective, from your standpoint, when these black officers start coming to you after they retired and saying, you know what, I saw this going on, I mean, I know your first response had to be, hey, brother, why didn't you say something while you was in there, while these kids were being electrocuted, having stuff clipped on, electrocuting you by your testicles? How is it that they didn't say anything? I mean, what was your response to them that, you know?
My response was, you coming forward, we're glad you're coming forward, we want you to testify. My instinct was, what's wrong with you? Are you losing your mind? How could you do this? But I didn't jump on them about it. But my instinct was to look at them and say, I don't get this. But my response was, you coming forward, you agreeing to testify, we need you to testify. That was my immediate response because I knew it wasn't just them. I've sued black cops for killing black people. So, you know, I understand this phenomena. And it's not new. I mean, we've gone through this since we hit the shores of what is now the United States, you know, during the enslavement. Free blacks were going to jail in large numbers, you know. After the enslavement, of course, you know, the so-called Reconstruction period, after that, blacks started going to jail, and there are very good books on that, because they were vagrant. They were unemployed, and they were putting them in these work camps and charging them out, renting them out, you know, all over the South and in the North. In Illinois, they were doing that, you know, and they did that for decades into the 20th century. And now they've switched on us. Now they're using the justice system, or we call it the punishment system, and they're doing some of the same things. They're criminalizing generations of young blacks, and young blacks now are saying, we're not going to take that. So we're having these young blacks that are emerging, they're trying to fight back. You know, we charge genocide, you know, and other groups around the country are fighting back. Because they're sort of getting it because they know what's happening to their contemporaries because they've been attacked. We got huge numbers in Illinois. The prison population in all states have grown. In Illinois, 65%, 67 actually, of the male prison population is black in Illinois. The number of black men in Illinois is probably less than 5%. Because the black population in Illinois is somewhere around maybe 12 to 15%. And black men are not the total population, obviously. So how did we get 67% of the male black, and indeed the female black population is growing. And that's going on in many cities. And that's why we're finding that a lot of the youth that we're trying to figure out what they're doing. You know, these kids out there shooting at each other. They're doing all this crazy stuff. They don't have what I had when I grew up on the west side of Chicago, and that was what we call the village to raise a child, you know, that African proverb. That village has been under attack for at least two or three decades, partly because of the war on drugs, war on gangs, but also the industrial base has eroded. You know, there are no industry jobs in Chicago. They've been pushed out of the workforce. They've been criminalized. And so a lot of these young kids are raising themselves. I do criminal defense work as well as suing cops. And many of my clients, fathers died from murders, mom got struck out on drugs, they raised themselves. And so we're trying to figure out what's going on. That's what's going on. The village that raised me, you know, because I wasn't perfect, but there was a perfect village around me. There was a perfect mom and dad who said, okay, boy, you might stay out late. We're going to let you stay out late at night because this is summer vacation. But you're going to church tomorrow. You know, I might be set up in church sleep because I didn't want to be there half the time. Or they say, I might be somewhere in the neighborhood. My mom would come out and say, Standish, she would call me. I might be five blocks away. But people will let me know, your mama calling you, boy. You better get home. And I'm headed home. That was the village that had not been eroded by drugs being pumped in it, by police attacking folks and sending folks to prison, including mothers. So all of that is going on right now that we have to find a way to repair it.
Mr. Willis, Lamont here. I'm sitting here listening to you, and I am taking in all that you're saying. And I think what troubles, and I'll pose a question to you as I make this comment, and I want to get your thoughts on it. Mm-hmm. You know, when I hear what you're saying, and Cliff referencing the horrific acts of torture with these young people, and you wonder why, as people go on news stations, and we ask the question, what is going on? Why are these people protesting and breaking cop cars and windshields and all these things? When I hear what you're saying tonight and what we are learning as a result of that which goes on, the United States torture chamber, not only in Chicago but all over this country because of the culture, how do you have to wonder why the response and the outrage from the African-American community is what it is? If this is an issue that has been going on for decades,
That young person who got tortured the way, this horrific way that Cliff just explained, and these folks that are getting tortured to confess, you, these are imprints that are left on the minds and hearts of people for a lifetime. These are, and not, you know what? What these kids and what these folks are going through, they're not going to counseling where they can get healing and all the things that are should be afforded them as a result of a trauma happening. They're just simply thrown away. They become a number. What are your thoughts as you look at all the responses, the protests, and all that is going on in this country right now? Would you agree that a culture has been set that people need to take a look from the perspective of these communities, what these communities have suffered, what they have endured trying to cope and heal and deal with the trauma and horrific things that have happened to them? Would you agree that is something that needs to be addressed? And my question to you, Mr. Willis, is how do we address that from your viewpoint as an attorney?
Well, it's a difficult question. I think we have to address it. I think every organization has to find a way to address it. I think the faith community certainly has a part. I think the sororities and the fraternities have a part. I think all adults that are in our community and our allies that are not in the community have a part. I think elected officials have to be responsible. I don't see a lot of that happening. What I see right now are the youth on the move, and hopefully they can sustain that. You know, youth are very often, you know, I was a youth in the 60s, and we changed the direction of a lot of things until the government cracked down on many of us under COINTELPRO and other devices. But the youth are moving forward. We should encourage them, but we have to move forward too. I see some members in Chicago, the faith community, they're having meetings and trying to deal with mass incarceration. Many people have been inspired by the book that Michelle Alexander wrote, and I think it was very good. It was very insightful. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's the book on the new Jim Crow. If you haven't read it, I would encourage your audience to buy it. It's a young black woman who basically looked at the mass incarceration. She did her research, and she's basically saying that mass incarceration represents the new Jim Crow. She's saying that the Jim Crow at the turn of the century doesn't even come close to the Jim Crow that we're seeing now as a result of this mass incarceration. And she's saying basically that people are going to prison in large numbers and staying there a long time, but when they come out, they become a part of a caste system. They can't get work. There are laws that have been put in place that say when you get out of prison, if your mama and dad stay in public housing, you can't stay there because if you're there, they're going to get kicked out. If they're in Section 8, you can't stay there. You can't get certain jobs. You can't get funding for education. You can't go into certain professions just because you have a felony conviction. So what are they supposed to do? Well, what they're supposed to do is go back and start selling drugs again so they can go into one of these privately owned prisons so people can make a profit from them going to prison. And that's what's going on. And it's a problem that if we don't solve in our community, we're going to have some real more serious problems in the future because these young people are not working and they're going to continue to sell drugs and be a prey on the community. And we have to help solve that so they will not be doing that and so that they will be productive again. And the challenge starts with us first. And I think these various organizations, including elected officials, have to begin to try to solve the problem. And I see some glimmer of hope in Chicago and other places. I think the federal government can do more. I would like to see some kind of urban plan we need jobs. I don't know what it's like in your town, but you know what the unemployment rate is in Chicago? It's staggering. The adult unemployment rate in Chicago for black people, this male and female, is 25%.
Oh, wow.
That's almost as bad as the so-called Great Depression of the 30s and 40s, which was usually in the 30, 32, 33%. The unemployment rate for teenagers, you may have to sit down for this one, is 92%. 92%. Oh. That almost means that none of our kids are working.
None of them.
Well,
none of them. 92% is almost like all of them are not working. That's staggering. If the unemployment rate in the white community is 92%, we'll be hearing about it all over the world. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
We'll never allow that to happen. If white people, 25% in the white community, it'll be a national, I mean, they will have you have to have some kind of a Marshall Plan to get them back to work. They would not allow that. The federal government and state government would not allow that. But they allow that in the black community.
And the fast, I mean, I know they got, I'm sure, 20, that's staggering. And then they wonder why teenagers are running idle and loose through the community doing things that they shouldn't do because they're not busy. What programs, that should be in place to keep these youngsters busy? Sam?
Mr. Willis, will you be able to stay with us just for a few more minutes on the other side of this
next
break?
Sure. I'll stay as long as you want me to.
Excellent, because we see on your profile sheet here that you organized a group called the Riverdale 8, and we were just doing a little bit of research on Riverdale, and it just kind of falls right in line with some of the things you were just talking about with regard to the depressed economy and so forth. And with Riverdale, it looks like it's on the south side as well. And so we'll talk a little bit about that when we come back, as we talk about tortured confessions and some of those kind of things. Lamont.
And, folks, if you're tuned in tonight, again, we've gone to another level of conversation that is informative and educational. It's right now on the East Coast, 10 after 9. Dinner's all put away. The dishes are put up. And maybe a hot pot of coffee is brewing on the stove. Go grab you a cup. Maybe a piece of coffee cake to go with it, even though it's not conventional. We'll see you back here shortly. This is AJC Radio, bringing the message of justice all around the world. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, can I ask you a question? Did you know that there are over 2.4 million people behind bars in the United States? I'll ask you one more question. Were you aware that that is the highest number of people behind bars in the entire world? The United States makes up of only 5% of the world's population, but we have over 25% of the world's prison population. America prides itself on being the most advanced and progressive nation on earth. However, sadly, we are also the world's most archaic. I'm going to give you a personal invitation to get involved with the fight against mass incarceration. Take a few moments to call 1-855-529-4252. That is a just cause. And we fight for justice. Again, call a Just Cause today. Don't delay. Call 1-855-529-4252. It is time, and I say high time, that we take America's incarceration seriously. Won't you join us? Call today.
How often does our justice system get it wrong, convicting innocent people of crimes they did not commit? A new project by the University of Michigan Law School and the Center for Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University School of Law tries to answer that question. In the last 23 years, more than 2,000 people have been convicted of serious crimes and later exonerated, according to the National Registry of Exonerations. By far, the largest segment was almost 1,200 defendants falsely convicted because of large-scale patterns of police corruption, generally in drug and gun cases. Of the remaining 873 defendants exonerated, nearly half were wrongly convicted of murder, and of that group, 101 were sentenced to death. On average, it took more than 11 years for a conviction to be set aside. Why does the justice system get it wrong? In homicides, the biggest problem is perjury and false accusation, most often by supposed eyewitnesses. False convictions in adult rape cases are primarily based on mistakes by eyewitnesses, while false convictions in child sex abuse cases are often for fabricated crimes that never occurred. 2,000 exonerations may seem small in a nation with more than 2.3 million people behind bars, but there are far more false convictions than the report contains. Most false convictions are never formally challenged, and those convictions that are successfully overturned receive little or no attention from the media, according to the report's authors.
AJC Radio, bringing the message of justice around the world. We've got a good subject going on this evening, and we want to again thank Mr. Stan Willis, attorney at law from Chicago, Illinois, talking about tortured confessions and shared some information about the situation that's going on in Chicago there with former police commander John Berg. And I want to invite our listeners to give us a call if you have any questions or if you have any personal stories to share. 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Again, Mr. Willis, before the break, we talked a little bit or asked you to be prepared to talk about the Riverdale 8. And that's another case where it looks like, but it involved women. You know, a lot of times when we talk about these types of stories or these situations with regard to our justice system, we tend to lean more toward the discussion on the male side. But as you stated earlier, the dilemma, the epidemic, if you will, is getting worse in the African-American community with regard to the incarceration of women. And it's all, you know, setting the stage to disrupt our family process, disrupt the strength that and the family unit. Let me put it that way. And so that contributes to, like you, when you were saying, a 90-plus percent unemployment rate with teenagers in Chicago or in Illinois. Yeah. That is staggering. I mean, that's like a formula for disaster right there. I mean, everyone's always sitting on pins and needles, especially when it gets to the summer months, because that's when it, the crime rates go up. And when you have a whole bunch of kids that have nothing to do, they're going to get creative. And unfortunately, yeah, for our communities, it's going to our kids are going to be found on the wrong end of that equation. Yeah. So, as far as the Riverdale 8, talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, that happened many years ago, and I don't even remember when it happened. Quite frankly, I think it was mid '90s, maybe. It was. I got a call from a lady who was a Chicago Transit Authority supervisor. And she said that she had gotten physically abused by police in her community, and she lived in Riverdale. Riverdale at that time had a population of about 14,000. It's a suburban area, kind of on the east side of Chicago. And so as I talked with her and I examined it more, I found out that there were other black women who were being abused by the local police department. And it seemed that what had happened, the demographics of that community had shifted rather rapidly. It had been a predominantly white community. I think it's predominantly Irish. And it had shifted till it was a majority black community. And I think this is the police's way of containing the black community by being abusive. And so we organize. I start going out to Riverdale on the weekends, organizing people, and we ended up with about five or six families where women had gotten abused, physically abused by police, and we started having meetings. We decided to have a rally at the police department, and we had several hundred people in Riverdale and, you know, in Chicago came out. And I ultimately ended up filing lawsuits. I didn't go out there to file lawsuits. I went out there to try to help empower those communities. Always, I came from the Chicago area, and my goal is to empower communities. I don't always go in just to file lawsuits because that doesn't necessarily empower communities. In fact, sometimes it undermines organizing because people, once you file a lawsuit, people stop organizing because they see the lawsuit as resolving the problem. So I tried not to file a lawsuit, and I ultimately did. Because they insisted on it, and if I had not, the statute of limitations would have run on it. But I went out there. I was going out there every weekend and trying to organize, and we were going door-to-door talking about the problems, and people were becoming organized. The problem was when I didn't go out there, they would not meet, and they would not organize. So they were relying on me too much to come out and help them organize, and that's not what I had in mind. My practice has been, because I came up in the black community, I went to public school, was to try to empower, using my legal skills and my organization skills, to try to help empower my community. So I've organized in the context of BIRDS. I organized black people against police torture, you know, pulling black people together to get the benefit of their genius into how to solve those problems. And we did a lot of things. We passed laws. We organized. We took a position against the Olympics coming to Chicago. We embraced the human rights mechanisms. I also organized in the mid-90s a group called African Americans of Free Mamiya Abu-Jamal. They were getting ready to, they had signed a death warrant for Mamiya in early 95. And so I organized that group. So that's my way of staying involved in my community and helping to empower my community. So the Riverdale 8, we resolved it ultimately by litigation, but that really wasn't the way I wanted to resolve it. I wanted to organize the community and then kind of pull away, and they, you know, with an organized community, I felt that they would stop these cops from doing what they were doing. So that's the Riverdale story. It happened many years ago.
All right. Well, you know, that's one of and when you're talking about organizing and when we look at that type of situation, and you have any group of people that are tortured or subjected to that type of treatment, you know, that's hopefully, you know, people will step up and start to take note and start to take action. That's one of the things we talk about quite often here on AJC Radio, is the fact that people tend to take a position of complacency, and they have that attitude that if it's not on my doorstep and if it's not affecting me and my family, then it's not a problem. Go ahead.
That's what you expect them to happen. What happened here with the Burge, that was organizing going on for years, and black people were not involved in any significant ways. And I decided that I would not allow that to continue to happen. I called town hall meetings periodically, and we organized out of those meetings of Black People Against Police Torture. Black people have to have, it's been my experience, they have to have some organizational form so that they can be involved in it, so they can express their feelings. And there was no organizational form for them to come together to deal with the John Birch cases until we start meeting and we organize Black People Against Police Torture. We didn't exclude our white comrades. We had several that were, you know, part of the group. But we had, you know, we have some pretty, you know, strong organizations. But unfortunately, the police stuff has not been on the front burner of a lot of the more organized civil rights organizations. So we have to organize it. And so that's what we did. We called people together, and I would have these meetings. I had, you know, some retired teachers, some teachers that were now retired, a couple of bus drivers. You know, whoever came because it was a public meeting. And people had good ideas because black people think about the black problem more than anybody think about the black problem. So they got ideas, but they don't have an organizational form where somebody's saying, look, let's get together and move forward around this issue.
Sure.
You know, they have a feeling about it, but let somebody, you know, do that, it don't happen. You know, you would think it would happen automatically, but organizing is a skill. And, you know, I've learned how to do it. Nobody taught me how to do it, but it's a skill. And you have to bring people together, and you have to hear, you know, you have to bring them together in a respectful way, and you have to kind of stand back and listen to them and you know, certainly inject ideas and be willing to work to trying to keep it moving.
And I think that's the bottom line. And for that work, Mr. Willis, we commend you for the efforts and what you've brought to this program tonight. Is something that's definitely going to stick with you without question.
So, Mr. Willis, for folks who are in the Chicago area, if they want to look you up and want to take advantage of some of your services and have some cases that they think you might be able to assist them with, how can they get in contact with you? What's your website there at your law firm?
Well, my phone number is 312-750-1950. My website is Stan Willis. It's better to reach me by phone.
Give that number one more time.
Yes, 312-750-1950.
All right, sir. Well, thank you again for joining us this evening. That's Mr. Stan Willis, a criminal defense and civil rights lawyer there in the city of Chicago. And sharing some
insight. Pleasure talking with you.
And just, you know, for folks, you might want to, and Mr. Willis, you might just want to let folks know that they can catch an archive of this interview at ajcradio.com. Again, ajcradio.com. Again, that's Mr. Stan Willis. Thanks again for joining us. We're going to take a quick break.
Take care.
And we will be back on the other side. Phone number is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. Lamont.
And, ladies and gentlemen, the words that come to mind are absolutely wow to a epidemic of torture on American soil. That is incomprehensible. It is deplorable. It is every adjective that comes to mind when you look at the fact that this is supposed to be the land of the free. We point fingers. We point at other nations and countries and world orders when we are lacking seriously right here at home. Old Chicago is just one of many. What are we going to do, America? Do we sit back? Do we take it? Not on AJC Radio. That's not going to happen. We continue to fight for justice and expose corruption on every level. Stand by. I'm Lamont Banks with Cliff Stewart, Charlisa Stewart, and Sam Thurman. Get ready. We need some answers. We're going to pick it back up right after the break. Did you know that racial or ethnic minorities make up over 60% of people in U.S. prisons? According to the Sentencing Project, 1 in 3 black men and 1 in 6 Latino men will likely spend time in prison in their lifetime. Now, this type of disparity simply is not good for our communities. This type of disparity is not good for America. Now is the time for judicial reform. Now is the time to fix injustice in America. Won't you get involved today? Give us a call, won't you, at 1-855-529-4252. Time for talking is over, but time for action starts right now.
and gentlemen of America, we find ourselves in a precarious situation as America, its citizens, stand at the crossroads of decision. Well, AJC Radio is committed. Coming June 4th, 2015, every Thursday evening, we will introduce a new campaign entitled Spotlight on Capitol Hill. The purpose of this campaign is to take each and every Thursday, we will spotlight a member of Congress and the initiatives that are important not only to them, but to their constituents and the nation and this country as a whole. Our purpose is to shine the light on congressmen, senators, men and women who are committed to the oath that they took when they were elected to public office. We find it very important that we would shine the light on something that is positive in a time of critical challenges that face this nation. So I invite you tonight to join us beginning June 4th, every Thursday, as we introduce Spotlight on Capitol Hill. As all Americans are trying to do, we are seeking justice. Join us for an exciting time of highlighting your congressman and your senator, that we might come together as a people and as a nation to bring about change. We look forward to you joining us June 4th and every Thursday thereafter. God bless you and God bless America.
Radio brings the message of justice around the world. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Mott Banks, Cliff Stewart, and Lisa Stewart. And this evening we have been talking about confessions that have been gotten as a result of torture. And as a case study, if you will, one of the things that we've highlighted was the situation there in Chicago. And as attorney Stan Willis broke it down for us, you know, that was... Like you said before the break, Lamont, it's shocking. I mean, it's one of those things that in this country, are you kidding me? And you know, and like you were saying, and I think Mr. Willis was saying, you know, it sounds like something that would happen in a third world country. And I guess, you know, the fact that they even had to get the United Nations involved, and when you talk about violations, human rights violations, you know, people get on their platform here in the United States all the time and want to point the finger at some tyrant or some dictator in another country and say, you know, we need to have his, you know, have him strung up or whatever and put him under the jail because of how he has treated the citizens of his nation. Now, we have that type of thing happen here. And let's just go right back to Mr. Burge. You have that exact same type of thing happen here, and the man gets convicted of perjury. Something's wrong with that picture.
No, absolutely.
Something is absolutely wrong with that picture.
Yeah, that's sick. That's like having, you know, let's just bring it home. Say you have, during the Holocaust, you have one of these war colonels. That, I mean, several of them got arrested.
They're still looking for
right.
Some of them.
Several of them got arrested, got brought up on charges, got executed.
Yes.
For torture. You take, then you come to America and say, we got the same type of situation. We got 100 men that were tortured. We're looking for the man. We find him. What do we charge him with and convict him of? Perjury. That is, then you say, well, America, that there's no way that the American justice system is as bad as Nazi Germany. That there's no way that we would commit atrocity such as the Holocaust and let people get away with it. If you're fine doing war crimes, you're going to be brought to justice based on the Geneva Convention. But then you come to America, you come to Chicago, and you say, you're found doing torture. It's just some black kids, so we're just going.
It's okay.
It's okay. We're going to give you, you know, a perjury charge.
put you in jail for 4 years, just as an appeasement to the community, because everybody really knows that you did the tortures. They want you to go to jail. We'll give you 4 years on a perjury. That is as sick as saying one of these colonels that did committed all these atrocities in the Holocaust, that all they would get is a perjury charge, and that the United Nations would say, well, yeah, you broke the Geneva Convention, but, you know, it's okay. They were just Jews. That is as sick as that.
And, I absolutely agree that, you know, these are things that, it, at least to my mind, it brings to the forefront that why the protests are at the level that they are in this country.
That's it.
It's kind of like the old saying when you was growing up, the straw that broke the camel's back. Over a period of time, you stack enough straws, they become strength. So my thought is that I think America has to step out of the position of denial. And that's why I get so frustrated when we hear time and time again with guests sometimes that will cleave to the fact, well, I still believe we do have the best system in the world. Wake up. We don't even have a semi-best system. We got one of the worst systems in the world.
Absolutely.
And nobody wants to just come out and say that and deal with that, man. You're torturing men by their private parts? Are you kidding me?
That right there goes to a whole nother level.
And how can you then even look in the mirror and say, we have the best system in the world? We absolutely do not. And I think the sooner Sam and Lisa and Cliff that we get to come to grips with that, maybe we can start some healing here and some recovery here. But until we just turn a blind eye and say that's going on. Just because you close your curtain out in your neighborhood and somebody's getting attacked on the street doesn't change the attack that's happening. You can't close your eyes to these things. It's too obvious. And that's why these communities are going crazy when things are happening with cops. And it's like, man, how much more is a community supposed to take?
I think, like we've talked a few times, that this is not a new phenomenon in the sense that all of a sudden these type of atrocities are occurring. With the advent of social media, you know, it's right now news. So something happens and, you know, you can look at any event around this nation now. And all you see, you know, people who are bystanders, cell phones are up, and they're rolling on the cell phone. They're snapping shots. They're immediately posting it on Facebook or Twitter or something like that. So the crimes, and I'm going to use your term, Cliff, the war crimes against the nation, against the people of this country, the war crimes at the hands of people like John Burge, that are now happening, they can't cover it for 20 years.
Right.
I mean, this man was covered for 20 years.
And then you give him a pension paycheck.
That's sick.
Hey, let's thank you right now. Come on up here and get an award, man, for the torture you did and all the stuff that you've done to people. And you wonder why America is at a racial divide in this country right now. And that's just the reality of what it is. And we've got to deal with that.
And you know that even when you look at the false confessions, and only the people who are involved know exactly what happened in their particular situation. But even the National Registry of Exonerations, it shows a bunch of cases of exonerees where they never even committed a crime. I mean, they did time based on a false confession. Now, what were they subjected to in order to for that false confession to come about? You know, were they prodded? It's like, you know, were they locked in a room for hours and hours and hours and hours? Who knows?
Yeah, well, there's situations and things that where, and I think going to the thing, you know, about false confessions, it tells you how far off we've gotten as a country. When I have to get a confession, I want to let you hear a clip from Rob Warden, who's dealing with false confessions. Play the clip.
When I got a call from a judge I knew who was troubled about a case that he'd just been involved in, he hadn't sentenced a young man. He'd just convicted him at a bench trial, a first-degree murder based on a confession. And a few days after the trial, The murder had been a two-year-old boy. The victim had been a two-year-old boy. The grandmother of the deceased child called the judge and said, Your Honor, there's been a terrible mistake. I found the weapon that killed my grandson. It was in my daughter's bureau drawer. She has admitted that it was a mistake, an accident. She didn't want to admit what happened. She made up a story of a shot being fired from the street, of course not thinking anybody would ever be arrested, much less that somebody would confess and be convicted of the crime. So the judge called this to my attention, and I was, of course, very intrigued by the case because I assumed that he must have been, this young man, his name was Lavelle Byrd, he must have been subjected to some extreme form of third world quality torture. And, you know, we've all heard in Chicago of horrendous cases, allegations of people having cattle prods poked into their genitals, of having typewriter covers put over their head to smother them, being dangled out of a third floor window by your ankles.
I mean,
is Suge Knight on the police force? I mean, you know.
I'm telling you, he's trying to get some, some master recordings or something. That sounds like something that you see in a movie.
And what he's explaining there is that all of this happened because somebody did not take responsibility for an accident. So let's just say we got shots fired from the street. Now, what type of torture did this young man have to go through in order to confess to a clear crime that he wasn't even nowhere around? That tells you the extent of the torture and the endurance that the human person was this young man was able to endure. He said, I can't take it. I did it. Just stop the pain. And we call this the land of the free? And we want to point fingers at other countries about human and civil rights violations? That's a double standard, man, if I ever heard it.
And, you know, even if you do some more research on this kind of thing, they have handbooks on this. I mean, it's like handbooks on interrogation, handbooks on false getting false confessions and so forth. There's a technique that's out there called the Reed technique. And it is a technique that is – now, the people who support this, they say that this technique is useful in extracting information from otherwise unwilling suspects.
Well, yeah, I bet.
Yeah. So, you know, so those are the supporters. Obviously, you know, they like it. Now, the ones who are critics of the Reed technique say that, you know, it is all it does is helps to facilitate extracting a false confession. It's a mind game. I mean, they put you in a situation. It's kind of like at some point during the interrogation, good cop, bad cop kind of thing.
Right.
And then all of a sudden they flip on you. And it's like, okay, crazy people are in the room interrogating me. And then they flip again, and they just toy with your emotions. They toy with your with the physical environment, because these type of interrogations can go on for hours upon hours upon hours. And then it basically comes down to a situation where it results in what they call a false memory. And so they have planted the seed so much into a person's head that you did it, that after 12 or 14 hours of sitting in a room, then you start to say, yeah, I did it. And like you said, Lamont, it's one of those things of, I'll say whatever you want me to say. I'll sign whatever you want me to sign. Just let me out of this room.
And we call this a judicial process. We call this is someone, according to the Constitution and the laws of this land that we are supposed to live by, is an innocent person sitting in an interrogation room and treated like a war criminal.
That's right.
And we call this justice system the best in the world. You have got to absolutely be kidding me.
Well, and you know, we did when we were a little while ago, we were doing some stories, and the number of children, you know, teenagers who have been incarcerated as a result of false confessions, that number is staggering. I mean, when we did one in from a case in New York, and we started to hear the same thing over and over, there was like a trend where someone would point the finger at him, and they would snatch this kid out of school, you know, 14, 15 years old, snatch him out of school, And before the parents can even get to the precinct, or before an attorney can get involved, they've extracted a false confession out of this
right.
guy. You know, and then they end up spending, you know, 15, 18, 20, 25 years in prison because the evidence, or the lack thereof, was stuck in a bag up on the top shelf back in the evidence room that, oh, we forgot it was there.
Or right. else it got tossed in the trash somewhere.
You know,
and then you can't find it.
The ladder wasn't high enough to get it off the shelf.
That's unbelievable. And I'm blown away here. I mean, we talk about the torture in prisons. We talk about the abuse of officers in the Department of Corrections all over this country. We talk about men dying in hot showers, being cooked to death by corrupt officers in our correction facilities. We said it last time on this show that there are people that believe that their mom and dad, if they're incarcerated, they're getting the best treatment, the best food. They've just kind of locked up, and that's the extent of their punishment. And when you see this stuff happening, and we said this the other day, from the time the handcuffs get put on, injustice prevails. Corruption prevails. From the very beginning, due process has failed. You might as well have the case vacated day one for the injustices that are happening in this country. I mean, imagine a teenager in an interrogation room that long, and I've heard stories of underage kids interrogated. No parent can you imagine the fear and the unknowing of what may happen to me? And we then stop and ask the question, why are these communities so outraged as they protest police brutality or other issues that are going on? It's where they live. You don't live there. What type of mental breakdowns have happened as a result of these interrogations? Sometimes there are people that will never be the same mentally from the things that they have suffered. It just, I mean, I hope America is tuning in and listening to this type of horrific behavior. The citizens of Chicago, you need to go on a march. You need to get out your homes, get out your car, and say, you know what? This is unacceptable. I mean, you got people in Wisconsin marching for the union
mm-hmm.
about injustices.
But you see these things that happen in these different communities, like we talked about before with the children, with the police chief that abused the children. Where is the outcry for that?
Where
is the voice for the children? Where is the voice for these tortured men in Chicago? I mean, yeah, reparations have been set up. But $5.5 million for 20 years of torture on 100 people, that is, and I mean, I understand it's a great start. It's it sets all these precedences. It's historical, all the great accolades, but it's pennies when you compare it to what these men went through. Just like when you lock somebody up wrongfully, like the individual, all these people that we're seeing coming out of prison after 20, 30, 40 years being locked up wrongly, and then they get out and they say, okay, well, we're going to give you $10,000 for every year that you spend in prison. That is a joke.
But what about the life that they lost?
Exactly.
What about the loved ones that they lost? What about all the special occasions and the times with their mothers, with their children, with their spouses, all the special things that you lose that you can never ever get back?
That's the
problem. Who's gonna repay them for that?
Exactly. And the system ensures that, you know, it's bad enough to put them in for without cause, then you let them out, and then you insult them. Let's say we're going to give you, you know, $10,000, $20,000 for each year that you were locked up. Pennies. And most of the time they never even get an apology from the person who put them in. And then what happens to the crooked prosecutor who held back the evidence? What happens to the prosecutor that knows that this person gave a false confession because of the way that, they were tortured to get that confession? Does that prosecutor, does he get brought up on charges? Do the police officers eventually get brought up on charges? Absolutely not. And then they want to tell America that, no one's above the law. The law is equal, justice for all. That is a justice joke.
It really is. I'm heartbroken tonight as I'm going through this conversation. I'm so sickened and saddened. I mean, put yourself in the position of a mother who knows your child is being tortured, and you want me to stand up with a patriotic eye and salute to a nation that refuses to deal with this? Because, because some of the stuff we talked about has been going on for decades. Chicago,
yes.
I'm naming, and it's all over this country, but Chicago, they've been known for torture after torture. The police department. And you wonder whether this is insanity to me, man.
And just like Mr. Willis said, I mean, this went all the way up to the state's attorney office. To judges sitting there saying, you know, it is just common sense as a judge. If several people keep coming to your courtroom and say, Judge, I didn't do it. They made me confess. They're torturing me. They're doing this thing to me. They're doing that thing to me. How do you as a judge not open up an inquiry and say, you know what, DA, prosecutor, we need to do an investigation to your department because too many people are coming up in front of this courtroom saying that something's going on. What's going on in there?
And you know what else, Cliff, is unnerving? You look at some of these cases where people are exonerated, supposedly, and then they release these people, but then they release them with restrictions. They release them on parole. How am I being put on parole when you've just found out that I've been serving time for a crime I never committed? I didn't do anything wrong. Then when you release me, I'm on parole?
Yeah.
How? Parole for what?
Look,
exactly.
I'll tell you the biggest joke in my case. As the verdict came down not guilty in the second trial, the prosecutor had the nerve to stand up. Your Honor, we asked that 2 years probation or parole be placed on Mr. Banks.
Yeah, and for what? He's innocent, but we want probation.
That's crazy.
My attorney said, can we note, Your Honor, she said so many amount of days that Mr. Banks is served. We ask that you don't even entertain.
Or can we note that he's insane?
That thought. You know what? It was so, and the judge never even addressed it. Never
it's
even.
It's like you're insane. You want me to put this man on probation?
No, he's innocent.
That we just found out is innocent. We just found out the greatest, the greatest moments of his life that he's been found innocent. He's getting out of prison because he never did anything anyway. Your Honor, let's give him 2 years probation. We respectfully ask the court to put him 2 years in probation. What?
Well, I'll say this. You disrespectfully ask the court.
Yeah.
To do such a thing. And ladies and gentlemen, as we wrap up a show that has left me speechless at times.
For the first time ever, I think I've never seen this before.
I'll tell you what, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to say this, and we're going to do the wrap up here, but I'll tell you, Sam, Lisa, Cliff, and America, I'm saddened by what we have heard tonight. It is enough to move any person to emotion. This is America. And our citizens are being tortured behind closed doors. But we put on the nice iron police suit, the police hat, and we say we are here to serve and protect where our children, our teens, cannot even get a job in Chicago.
Yeah.
We're in trouble, America. I'm going to say we got to fight this fight together, and we appreciate Mr. Willis to join us tonight. I am a little bit choked up, folks, so pardon me in the emotion. It's time to move and do something.
And you know, Lamont, I was just thinking that, I like to look at cop shows and that type of thing. It just happened to catch Chicago PD last night. And that's one that has a lot of intensity in it.
Sure.
But, you know, you're familiar with the term art imitating life. And now, you know, television and all that kind of stuff, a lot of times supposed to be, you know, not reality, but
sure.
Art imitating life. And to hear Mr. Willis, and then you read some of these things, the accounts of John Burge and all this kind of, some of the things that Burge did are some of the things that was on Chicago PD last night. And they would even go to the extent of cops killing cops in order to keep their enterprise going. I mean, if they was getting, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars under the table for protection or whatever, if someone found out about it and threatened to turn them in, they'd just as soon take you out.
And I'll say this, Sam, very quickly. Ladies and gentlemen, as you have tucked the kids in tonight, they're getting ready. They're probably asleep by now. It is almost 10 o'clock on the East Coast. We said last time on this program, this is for the children and their children. We wake up under the blanket of freedom, but it's actually skewed. It's time for change. Let's make that change.
Join us each week right here on AJC Radio, where we're bringing the message of justice around the world. Each Tuesday and Thursday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, we invite you to join in. We're going to have always have intriguing and interesting dialogue. Lisa.
Yes, we want to ask everyone out there to go out to a website called GoFundMe.com. Again, that's GoFundMe.com. Do a search on IRP6. You'll find a link out there where you can donate to directly to the IRP6 families. That would be the children and the spouses left behind from these men who have been wrongfully convicted, been serving right at 3 years now that they've been in prison for a crime that they never committed, for never, ever breaking the law, and their families are suffering as a result. So everyone, dig deep, do what you can. Everyone can't do the same thing, but everybody can do something. Do whatever it is that you can do to reach out to these families.
For archives of our program, go to ajcradio.com. Live365.com for 24/7 programming. And then each Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time, catch us at prn.fm. That's the Progressive Radio Network. And then for on-demand programming, go to the 405radio.com as well as iTunes. Mr. Stewart.
Yeah, I want to say thank you to everyone in the chat room, all of your questions and comments. It's appreciated. To everyone on the phone, I know we didn't get to some people that were on hold, but we wanted to make sure that we got all the information out, and wanted to give Mr. Willis, who we appreciate, Stan Willis, for coming on and spending part of your evening with us. You know, we appreciate all the things that you have to say and the information you enlightened us with. Also, we want to say thank you to our production team, K&D Productions, Captain Kyle, Dustin Jackson, helping out Ill Skillers Girl in the control room to make sure you hear what it is we have to say. To our production support team, they've been on the ball lately, giving us that accurate and up-to-date information so that we can pass that on you into the truth. We know you're out there. We appreciate it.
I want to say a quick thank you to Olivia, to Miss Barbara, to Lynette, all of you that are out there doing work for us, making sure that our job goes a little smoother, a little easier. We appreciate everything that you guys do.
And please keep our brothers in prayer, the IRP6. That's David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. Unceasing prayer for them. And I also want to ask that you like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. We've got a lot of activity going out there on that, so we would certainly appreciate your support. That's another wrap. That's a wrap. For Lamont Banks, Cliff Stewart, and Lisa Stewart, and the rest of the AJC Radio team, I'm Sam Thurman. Good night, America.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over that. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. Huh?